I trust Atlas Butler because they've been a local company for over 100 years. Not that you should trust everyone just because they're local. Atlas Butler, yes. Guy who sells watches out of his car, maybe not. Call
1-800-FURNACE. This Week in Retronauts is brought to you by Captain Commando. And by Captain Commando, I mean, you know, the original dude who was on the Capcom NES manuals, not the video game character who was some poser. Hi, everyone. This is Jeremy Parrish, and welcome to Retronauts, episode 19 Pocket, brought to you by Larry Fronsek, who has requested many things. And the one we decided on was, let's talk about Capcom's NES games, because we've played a lot of them. And what the heck? It goes kind of nicely with last episode when we talked about Nintendo Power. Mm-hmm. Let's just get all Nintendo up in here. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So with me this week in the studio, Bob Mackey, Ray Barnhold.
Hi.
The usual rabble.
Yes, indeed.
We're going to talk about some NES games, some of them good, some of them bad, but all of them interesting within a historical context.
Just the way I like it.
Yeah.
We're going to roll right into Capcom, talking about their NES era. So the NES era is actually kind of synonymous with Capcom itself. The company was established, I want to say, 1983. Their first games were Vulgus, Exidexes, Sunsun, all from 1983. And they entered the Famicom market in Japan early in 1985. And, you know, so that when the Nintendo launched, NES launched in America, and third-party titles started to roll out in 1986, they were right there in the first wave. So they released some of the first NES games as such, you know, like Capcom, NES, Nintendo, all kind of tied up inextricably together. And they, you know, they were, I think, actually, besides Nintendo, the first company to use really strong visual branding for their games. They use that packaging, which had the kind of like the blue background with the three-dimensional skewed neon grid.
Right.
And then artwork was inset into that. Kind of logo at the top.
The very picture of the 80s.
Yes, yes, exactly.
Did Konami, did they do their thing before Capcom? Because they had the gray boxes.
The silver boxes. I think those actually came after Capcom.
Okay.
I mean, they're... Yeah, everyone always mixes up Capcom and Konami as a joke. That's like a long-running joke on NeoGAF, I know. Mm. And it's actually, you know, kind of founded in the fact that those two companies do have kind of a similar place in the NES pantheon.
Like, right.
They were both companies that made strong visual branding for their packaging and produced excellent video games, top-notch graphics, top-notch music. Sometimes there were, some missteps, but... Generally speaking, like, if you bought a game from those companies, you knew, like, oh, this is going to be good. So, let's talk a little bit about Capcom. So Capcom entered the Famicom market, like I said, in 1985. And originally, Capcom was an arcade company. That's where they got their start. And Famicom was kind of their first entree into the home market. They did do some licensing of some of their games to, companies to publish on C64 and other platforms, especially in Europe, a lot of PCs. But the published games, the Famicom games and NES games, were the ones that they were the first to publish themselves. Mm-hmm. That was a really torturous sentence. I'm sorry. it's been a long session here.
Yeah.
That was kind of where they dipped their toe into the market. And it made sense because, you know, in 1985, the Famicom market in Japan was just exploding. It was super popular, really, you know, just doing well. Millions of systems were selling. And anyone who published a game on Famicom could be almost absolutely guaranteed that it was going to sell really well. So they jumped into the home market, and at first, because they were an arcade company, they did not have in-house console development. So their first few games were outsourced to a company called Micronics.
Oh.
Like so many other of these companies, though.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, certainly they were hardly the only one. If you look at, if you go to Game Developers Research Institute, you can find a list of games developed by the ghost house known as Micronics. But, you know, a lot of that information has come about through detective work, because there are certain trademark characteristics of Micronics games, certain sounds like the pause jingle, you know, kind of the way Konami had like its distinctive pause jingle.
Oh, I love that.
Micronics had their own, but it wasn't as distinctive.
Yeah, exactly.
Also, the fact that their games usually ran at like 12 frames per second and looked terrible and sounded terrible.
Yeah.
Yuck. I mean, the first few games that Micronics published for Capcom were 1942, which is an infamously terrible NES port. I mean, the arcade game was pretty fun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but that also had some problems.
It did, but, you know, it was playable.
Yeah.
It was a decent game.
Yeah.
But the NES version played like crap. It was sluggish, bad frame rates, poor collision detection, ugly as hell. And also the arcade music was like kind of like a staccato Morse code rhythm, which somehow turned into just like these ear-splitting bleeps when it came to NES. So not a good start. Ghost and Goblins, also a pretty famously terrible NES conversion.
Yeah, I it seems like a lot of people like that version or did at the time. But when I played it at the time, I was just like, this game is ugly and it's hard. I mean, it was always supposed to be hard, but it just felt like sub NES, like it was supposed to be on another console.
Right.
It just landed on the NES.
Oh, man. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, Ghost and Goblins, you know, the arcade version, is kind of a remarkable game because it's an early scrolling platformer that came out around the same time as Super Mario Brothers.
Mm-hmm. I think it was 85.
It was like a month or two after Super Mario Brothers. So, you know, it was happening in tandem with the development of Super Mario. And, you know, everyone credits Super Mario for being sort of the revolution in game design that it was. And I do think Super Mario Brothers is a better game, just better designed, more substantial, less unfair, less abusive to players.
Yeah,
but Ghost and Goblins looked great. It had some really interesting mechanics, some of them interesting in a bad way, like, you know, being forced to play the game through a second time to see the true ending with a certain weapon in hand. Like, that's, you know, not really intuitive or friendly. You had things like the red armor or whatever it's called that would swoop down and just instantly kill you. Like, it was a hard game. Not nearly as fair as Super Mario Brothers, but still, like, kind of revolutionary. The NES version just always felt kind of janky.
That's true. But in some ways, it did also sort of still have the physics of the arcade game.
Like, it did.
You know, Arthur's gravity is very distinct, and they sort of replicated that in the NES version. So, I mean...
Yeah, the way he jumps kind of reminds me of the way Donkey Kong Jr. jumped in Donkey Kong Jr., where he like kind of splays himself out in midair, and it's a little hard to judge where you're going to land.
Yeah, you're right. Exactly. But still not a great port, considering.
And is this a good time to mention Tokuro Fujiwara?
Yeah, I was actually.
Okay, sorry. I didn't have hands in front of me. But he's sort of like the Miyamoto of Capcom, early Capcom. And I guess he left Konami after a year. Oh, he left. He joined Konami in 82, but
that's right. He worked on Rock and Rope, didn't he?
Yeah. But he was behind like Ghosts and Goblins. He eventually left to form Whoopi Camp, which they did Tombo 1 and 2, but like a really influential figure.
Yeah, he worked on Mega Man. He worked on the arcade Bionic Commando.
Yeah.
There's kind of a visual style that his games have, sort of this cartoonish look to it. Like, you know, that was what was really striking with Ghosts and Goblins. And if you look at... you know, Bionic Commando in the arcade has that same look.
Mm-hmm. Pudgy characters.
Really distinctive. And his games also, you tended to have sort of unique mechanics and tended to be really, really hard.
Right. And, I mean, everyone has left Capcom of note, basically, today. But a lot of the big guys from back then, like Kamiya and Mikami, people like that, he was their mentor.
Mm-hmm. So Inafune also.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
I mean, Inafune has actually referred to him sort of as my mentor.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, there's definitely a lot of respect for the guy. He's one of those people that I really hope to interview someday.
And Oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Oh, and strangely enough, we just brought up this game a few episodes ago, but he was the last thing he worked on was Mad World.
Oh, yeah?
Original game design.
Huh.
So very strange, but Platinum, so it makes sense. There's a connection there.
Yeah, I wonder what he's doing these days.
Interesting.
Well, in any case, so yeah, these early NES games, did you guys play? I mean, obviously you played Ghosts and Goblins. Did you play the 1942 port?
Yeah.
Did you like it?
No.
Okay. I didn't. It just wasn't available where I was, so.
Yeah. I haven't played the Famicom version of Sunsun, which is, Sunsun's kind of a weird game. It's like a auto-scrolling platformer with multiple levels.
Mm-hmm.
Not one of Konami, or not one of Capcom's better games.
No, it's beginning.
Ah! Not one of Capcom's better games, but fun enough. Like, it has a lot of neat little details to it.
More original than Sunsun 2.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is just a straight-up platformer for PC Engine.
Yeah, but it's hard to know exactly when Capcom switched to in-house development for its Famicom games, but I know it did happen somewhere in there, sometime between 1985 and 1987, because I just hosted a panel at Game Developers Conference where Keiji Inafune was talking about developing the original Mega Man, and he referred to that as the first sort of in-house developed Capcom console game. You know, the home console division, he said, was really just there to do arcade to console ports.
Mm.
And they sort of broke the rules a little bit and developed their own game just because they wanted to do something different. I've also heard that Mega Man was supposed to have been an arcade game originally.
Mm.
And there's all kinds of different like half stories floating around about it. But in any case, it was Capcom's first, nothing else, their first original franchise, you know, intellectual property for a console that didn't have an arcade equivalent. Before we got to Mega Man, you know, you had these other games that came from Capcom in various levels of decency, like the early release of Commando has always struck me as being possibly one of those Micronics or similarly outsourced games, maybe Tosei or something.
Yeah.
It's really, really kind of a mess.
It's pretty rough, yeah.
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 Like, it's full of secrets, but it's just kind of like you randomly chuck grenades at things and they show up,
which
I realized that was like part of the arcade game too, but it's just very graphically rough. And I don't know if that's because it was outsourced to a lousy developer or if it's just the internal development team didn't have a lot of experience. But sometime shortly after Commando, there was like a really significant uptick in the quality of Capcom's NES games. And I'm thinking specifically of two console conversions, Trojan and Section Z.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if you guys have played either of those, like arcade or home versions.
I vaguely remember Trojan.
Okay.
Was that – okay, I could be wrong. That is a brawler?
Kind of.
Okay.
You're a dude – okay, so you have a sword. Yeah. You have a sword and a shield.
Yeah, okay.
And it's pretty much like, you know, like a proto Final Fight kind of game.
Mm-hmm.
But you actively use your shield. And it's a little flaky, but it's a pretty interesting game. Like there are bonus areas, you drop down into sewers and stuff. It's all very post-apocalyptic.
Okay.
There's like dudes who pop out of manholes and windows and throw knives at you. And you know, you block and attack, and it's a pretty tough game. You can like swipe in certain areas and power-ups will appear and you can get those and jump higher and become stronger.
That's right.
And
it's like a high fantasy Fist of the North Star.
Yeah, kind of. But it was a much higher caliber of audio-visual quality than previous Capcom home games.
Yeah.
And it also, you know, like just played better. It felt more solid. That's the first of Capcom's home games that I've actually been able to beat.
I
don't know if I could finish it now, but, you know, back in my idiot savant NES days, I was able to play through it and had a pretty good time with it.
Yeah.
But
I played Section Z as well. I mean, all things considered, the arcade version of that is still leagues better. But yeah, it's compared to, let's say, 1942.
I actually kind of disagree.
Okay, well.
But I mean, this is a thing, though.
Aesthetically?
Like, to me, Section Z is sort of the prototypical Capcom NES arcade conversion. You had the early ones.
Yeah.
But starting with Section Z, they stopped doing just pure arcade conversions and started really just reinventing the games. I mean, you saw that with Bionic Commando
okay, yeah,
and 1943. Like, they started adding these new elements in.
Okay, maybe I'm misremembering then. But yeah.
So the arcade version of Section Z is kind of an early version of Sidearms or
sure.
what is the name of the game with the two dudes, 2P and like you're flying around?
Scat?
No, it's, you know, Forgotten Worlds.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really very much a prototype to that because you've got a little dude with a jetpack and you can shoot forward and you can shoot backward and you fly, you can move through 360 degrees and it's auto-scrolling, you know, left to right. But Section Z in the arcade is just a strictly linear game. You start at Section A and you fight through to Section Z and blow up the boss and that's it. But on the NES, it's a really different kind of game. It's it's still a, you know, an auto-scrolling shooter, and
yeah.
You can still shoot left and right and move through 360 degrees, but the linearity is just thrown out the window, and it becomes almost mm-hmm. like this exploratory proto-Metroid game. Like, it seems maybe inspired by Baraduke
okay.
by Namco to some,
yeah.
reason, some degree.
Yeah, I can see that.
Okay. But it's a really, like, I think it's a really good game. It's also really hard in the American version because it was originally released for Famicom Disk System. And it had like the ability to save your progress, which was totally stripped out for the American version.
Of course.
So the US version is really hard, but it has some interesting mechanics to it. So, you know, you fly through levels and at the end of most levels, you come to two portals and you have to pick one or the other portal and you don't know where it's going to take you, but it takes you to a different stage. And so you kind of end up mapping your way through the different areas of the, you know, of the game, and there are hidden rooms and power ups and things along the way. It has a really strange energy system where you have like 20 points of health, and if something shoots you, you lose points of health. But if you collide with something, whether it's, you know, the walls or another enemy or something, then it instantly kills
okay.
you
no.
and deducts some of your energy. Like, it sends you back to the beginning of the stage and takes away some of your energy. But if you lose all of your energy and die, then you're taken all the way back to the beginning of the game.
Not cool.
Until you beat the first boss, at which point dying takes you back to like the start of that section. But there's like this real maze element to it and a lot of discovery. Like, you have to find the secret power-ups and you know, you shoot places and it has a missile power up where you like hit both attack buttons at once and a missile appears in the middle of the screen and you can grab it and shoot it.
Right.
It's kind of abstract, but, you know, as an early NES game, it's it has a great soundtrack.
Hmm.
It has really solid play mechanics. It's an interesting game. It's very complex and maze-like and kind of has an appeal to you know, the sort of player who would like Metroid, such as me.
Right. Well, then, fair enough. I guess I was gravely mistaken or something. granted, I also very frequently confuse Section Z with Sacross.
Oh, yeah.
Sacross
was like a
different company, yeah. Okay.
That was SCI, I think.
Yeah.
What about Zexies? Am I thinking of something
that
else?
That was Konami. You're getting Konami and Capcom.
And it's a little guy flying around, too, though, right?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, wait. Zexies was Hudson, actually, wasn't it?
Hudson.
But
yeah.
Same kind of premise, though, right?
Kind of.
They
didn't have the
name
element.
There's Air Fortress.
Ah!
Yeah.
There were a lot of little shooter dudes.
Yeah,
I know.
NES. But yeah, Section Z has always just been memorable because it does have that sort of complexity of the maze-like element. And another similarity to Metroid is that the final boss is called L Brain. It's a brain in space that you have to blow up.
Leather Brain.
Leather Brain.
Is that what it is?
Maybe.
That's gross. So, you know, those were sort of Capcom's early games, but then Mega Man came out and changed everything.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't you guys talk a little bit?
We've never talked about Mega Man on Retronauts.
You guys talk a little bit. I've been...
It's this weird little game no one ever cared about. Ray, I don't know.
It's about a robot named Rainbow Mighty Kid. Was that one of the original names? Rainbow Warrior Mighty Kid or something? Yeah.
Kind of like, looks like Astro Boy.
Rainbow Mika. That's from Street Fighter.
No, that was one of Mega Man. That was the original name of Rockman.
Oh, yeah?
Remember? They had a bunch of different names he was trying to figure out for them. And Rainbow Warrior, Mighty Kid. So yeah, Mega Man is cool. It's a robot guy. And, yeah, he has his little pea shooter arm cannon thing. Looks like a pea shooter anyway. And then, obviously, you go through these stages to fight a boss character at the end, and if you defeat them, you get their weapon. And their weapon is usually kind of a fun thing. It's a lot different than the standard weapon, and more often than not, you will that weapon will be strong against the next boss, perhaps, or perhaps another boss who is weak to that particular weapon.
Well, and that's the thing. There is no next boss because the game presents you at the beginning with six levels that you can choose in any order.
Mm-hmm. Capital P, perhaps, is what I meant there. But yeah. Yeah, you can freely choose any stage and, determine your own order or just go with what is supposed to be the order according to the weaknesses. Yeah. Hmm. And then after you beat all those bosses, you go to face the big bad guy, Dr. Wily, who I think 8 times out of 10 is not really Dr. Wily.
Yeah. Well, one thing you could tell me if I'm crazy or not is like in Mega Man 1, which was 87, I noticed that there was a real attempt for like a manga style because he was very Astro Boy looking. So all the characters had these black outlines around them, which was not a motif that was used that often at that point for any sprites. I thought it gave them a much more – they really popped off the screen.
Yeah, right.
Unlike Mario or like all those Micronics ports. Where it was just like there was no outline around the characters. So by Mario 2 and stuff, that would be like a standard thing for sprites in NES games. But I feel like Mega Man was one of the first to sort of go for that hand-drawn style by having black outlines.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at games that were contemporary with Mega Man, you have, you know, like Castlevania was the year before. The Legend of Zelda was the year before. But, I think around the same time we had – released in Japan, Final Fantasy,
sure,
and Zelda 2. And those were like kind of the high end of video game design at that point.
Oh, yeah.
Mega Man was right up there with them. Like it looked great.
Mm-hmm.
The physics were really solid. The controls were tight. It had a lot of varied controls like, you know, slippery ice levels. It had, you know, all the different weapons you could acquire plus a non-weapon called the Magnet Beam that was, you know, just for helping you navigate the stages. You could theoretically play the game in any order. I mean, some levels were unreasonably difficult if you just jumped in and played them first.
Yeah.
But, you know, in theory that was there. And then there were the bonus levels at the end, the boss levels. And those had some really crazy difficult bosses. Plus, you had to rerun through the boss gauntlet of the previous robot masters you just defeated. And then the final boss had two forms. So that was a lot of content and a lot of complexity within a video game. And it's really impressive that it came from this house that, you know, really only focused on arcade style experiences, because it did demonstrate, you know, along with Section Z, much more of a console development mentality and showed a sea change going on there. I will say that at the same time, you know, in 1987, you had games like Black Tiger.
Right.
Where Capcom was starting to think, you know, along the lines of Wonder Boy sequels, like, why don't we take these arcade experiences, which are, you know, really simple brawlers or action games, and add some hooks to them, you know, whether it's hidden areas or some kind of economy where you can buy stuff at shops and change up the experience and reward players for doing well and make it, you know, give them more options. But, you know, Mega Man was definitely a console game. Like, it's a game that really wouldn't have worked in the arcade. So to me, that really kind of says, like, this is the point at which, like, Capcom's home division came into its own and became its own entity, creating its own games. It wasn't just making ports. It wasn't just converting games and fancying them up. It was coming up with new ideas that really just were suited perfectly for the Famicom and NES.
It may have been a good arcade game if, like, every stage was half as long.
Right.
Yeah.
But fortunately, that's not how it went.
Yeah.
I mean, the stages are just right for the NES. You can beat the game in maybe, like, an hour if you know it well. But maybe less than that. I don't know. But, you know, it's challenging. It's really tough. But it's also pretty fair. As long as you have the right weapon, you can get through any situation. And part of the challenge of Mega Man and all of its sequels, really, is figuring out, like, where can I start out? What level is good to work through with just the basic weapons?
Yeah.
And then from there, figuring out, like, well, now that I have this new weapon, how can I where's the best place to go from here?
Yeah. I haven't figured that out with Mega Man 10 yet.
I've only played through that once, so yeah, I can't really speak to that. But, you know, following Mega Man and Section Z, you started seeing some really inventive, dramatic reinventions of arcade games coming from Capcom. They were creating original console titles, and then when they were converting their arcade games to NES, you know, they realized that, like, we're making some really great-looking arcade games, and we're not going to be able to sell just on visual appeal on the NES, so we have to add more to them.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the changes are a little controversial, but I'd say by and large, they were pretty successful. I mean, Bionic Commando was a totally different game on NES and, in my opinion, is one of the best games of the 8-bit era on NES, whereas the arcade game is kind of interesting and neat, but not really that great.
And Little Nemo, as well, as also an arcade game. I'm not sure which came first, but the
Little
arcade...
Little Nemo, no.
Oh, I played the arcade game by
Capcom. Are you thinking of Willow?
No.
Little Nemo.
There was a Nemo arcade
Maybe
game.
Maybe not in America.
Oh, just Nemo. Okay.
Right. Yeah.
It came after, I believe.
But there was no animal suit mechanic or anything. It was just a straightforward. I guess you threw candy or something. I forget what you did, but it looks really good. I remember it looking really good.
I hesitate to call it a run and gun, but that was basically what it was.
Yeah. I think the NES version kept the train auto scrolling stage, but it was a much different interpretation of that. But I mean, Willow as well was a different arcade game, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, totally two totally different games. To the point that I wouldn't even consider them related.
Yeah.
Whereas Bionic Commando was just like adding tremendous depth and refinement to a really neat idea in the arcade.
Hmm. Right.
1943, you know, they retained the fact that it was a shooter, but they added a very slight RPG system to it in that you could, you know,
you were
given skill points and you could customize how your fighter worked. Added a password system, so, you know, it wasn't just something you had to play through in a single grueling session.
Right.
Strider was a completely different game, and that wasn't actually a conversion of the arcade game. They were developed in tandem.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we talked about that. Oh, wait, no, future episode.
Yeah.
Boy, we got to stop recording these out of sequence.
You mentioned Willow. I've always wondered, is that worth playing through? It was never available to me as a kid. I know the music is great.
I really liked Willow when it was first released. I don't know how I would think about it, how I would feel about it now.
Hmm.
It's a very Zelda-style game.
Yeah.
With some, like, kind of some weird limitations. Like you have to reach, it has an RPG leveling system and you have to reach certain skill levels in order to be able to wield certain swords that you've acquired.
Hmm.
So you can get like the great, you know, the high level weapons early on, but you can't use them until you have the requisite skill level.
Hmm.
So it's a little bit weird.
Have you played it, Ray?
No.
Okay.
Actually, I know a few of my friends had it as a kid, but it never appealed to me.
I mean, it's pretty short and simple.
Okay.
I think I played through it in a weekend back in the day. As far as NES Zelda clones go, I like Crystalis a lot better.
Sure. Oh, yeah.
Crystalis, how you pronounce it.
Uh-huh.
Let's see. Some other arcade conversions. Street Fighter 2010, which wasn't originally really a Street Fighter game. Yeah.
What a weird
Japan.
Game.
It is.
Yeah.
They just kind of shoehorned some Street Fighter names into it.
Yeah.
I know. Oh, man.
It's a strange game. It's really complicated and really kind of unfriendly,
yeah,
but it looks great.
I remember renting it, and like the game starts, and you have to find the enemy. You have to fight. How does it work? Do we know like what the I just remember being very unintuitive.
Yeah.
It's not what you think it will.
You have to defeat an enemy, and then you have like 10 seconds to escape from the level. Or
that's what I'm thinking of. Yeah, just one thing I could never get over, and that might have been it.
It's kind of like Alien Soldier,
from Treasure.
It's like a precursor
like
to that.
It's super complex and dense,
and it takes place in the far off year of 2010.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I never actually played the game back in the day because I was like, the first time I discovered it was after I discovered Street Fighter 2,
mm-hmm.
and I just said, well, this is stupid.
Yeah.
It is.
What is this crap?
But,
you know, I actually did finally play it in 2010.
Okay.
Because I was like, hey, it's 2010. I should play Street Fighter 2010. So I played it, and I was like, oh, this is really hard and not intuitive at all, but it's pretty kind of good in its own way.
Maybe just watch the Game Center CX episode.
Yeah. Ooh, I will do that. That's cool.
And then finally, the last of the notable Capcom arcade conversions, at least that I can think of, is Mighty Final Fight. Which,
yeah.
Oh, I love it. Right.
Which was really, really cool. Was that two-player? I never played it.
Boy, I don't think so, actually.
But, Capcom released Final Fight as one of the first notable games for Super NES. It was horribly compromised. But then on NES, they were just like, let's make everyone a midget.
This feels like a Kunio game.
It seems more fitting.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is. And it also has an experience system, like 1943 almost.
And River City Ransom.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. But not as deep, but pretty fun. I mean, yeah, this was released in like 93, I think.
And so, really late.
What you said, Final Fight was one of the first Super NES games. This is one of the last NES games. And so, it has a high bar of quality.
And that's on the Japanese Virtual Console for 3DS, so I assume it's going to make its way west at some point.
It was on the Game Boy Advance Capcom Mini Mix.
It was, along with Strider and
Bionic Commando.
Yes. That was a pretty good compilation, except everything was squished because of the Game Boy Advance. In terms of, those were the arcade conversions, which were, pretty ambitious and pretty... I think they were canny. They were created with an awareness that the NES just couldn't recreate the arcade experience. So let's give people something that's better suited to the console.
Yeah.
But then they also created a lot of original games based on licenses, mainly Disney licenses.
Oh, yeah.
Starting with Mickey Mouse Capade, which they actually didn't create. They licensed that from Hudson.
Mm-hmm. What a bad
and
start.
It was poopy.
Yeah.
And I think I've said before on Retronauts that because it was so terrible, I completely ignored every other Capcom Disney game. I was like, DuckTales, what crap? No, a friend of mine did Rent Rescue Rangers. I was like, that was okay. Surprising that they managed to make something decent here. I skipped all the other ones. Adventures in the Magic Kingdom, The Little Mermaid.
Well, that one isn't that.
DuckTales, Tailspin, Chip and Dale's Rescue Rangers 2.
Mickey Mousecapade, just the sprites alone are just terrifying. I mean, nothing is depicted as it should be in that game. It just, I don't even know, like, was it an 86 Famicom game or something? It felt like it was much earlier.
It was
earlier.
Really early.
Yeah. I think Hudson's Bee shows up in a Capcom game for the only time in the
It looks and feels a lot like Adventure Island.
Lots of weird like early Famicom-y secrets, like a lot of invisible things that are hidden. Just a lot of really strange mechanics, like getting mini stolen from you.
Well, of course, you can blame Hudson for 90% of that crap.
Yeah, it's all Hudson.
In the whole pantheon of all those.
My own secret castle. That's what it feels like in its own way. Yeah.
Which is Hudson.
Yep.
Yes. If Darkwing Duck is like Mega Man, then certainly.
So I don't know if you guys want to talk any about the NES Disney games.
Well, I mean,
they're probably worth talking about to some degree.
Right, right.
There's been an episode.
There has been an episode if you want to look up. We did it at 1UP. I'm not sure where it is now, but you can find it. But it went over all the Capcom NES games and probably even the Super Nintendo ones. I don't remember. But what struck me about those games and just like Mega Man was just the really great use of the limited technology where every pixel on that sprite was meaningful, especially when they were trying to translate a very expressively drawn character to this tiny little squat representation, down to like Uncle Scrooge, who had like the top hat, the spats, the glasses, the everything. There's so much detail packed into that character, and I think that's Inafune who did that art.
Yeah.
So I guess we can blame him or congratulate him or whatever you want to say. But that was important. Just the representation of the characters as they looked was just a very important part of those games. I mean, they were good games to begin with, but the quality was there from just like the art onwards.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And, other internally developed stuff after the success of Mega Man, Capcom was like, okay, don't do any more of those. But they made Mega Man 2 anyway, and that did really well. So all of a sudden, Mega Man became this annualized thing, and interest seemed to drop off pretty quickly. Did you guys actually follow Mega Man in the day?
I tried to. I mean, I've said this before. I was into Mega Man 4 but I didn't actually buy it or end up owning it. Then years later, I would get 5 and 6.
Yeah.
I like 6 a lot, actually.
But before X came along, I think 4 was the last one I was excited for. After that, it just felt like...
Right.
Yeah, yep,
same here.
Mega Man X, yeah.
Like, yeah, I've had enough.
But I eventually rented 5 and 6 and beat them. They felt like much easier than, you know, the ones before, but they were okay. I just, Napalm Man, kind of creepy.
Yeah. I rented 5 and just couldn't stay interested in it long enough to beat it. But in retrospect, I do think 6 is probably the most overlooked game in the franchise. Mm-hmm. Or at least that series.
Is that the one Nintendo published?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, I thought so.
Yeah, because at that point, Capcom was like, who cares?
Yeah. You take this.
And it's probably just as well that they ended up, you know, Nintendo ended up taking duties, because otherwise that would have been one of those holy grail things for years.
Oh, yeah. Oh, Lord. Weird. I guess we talked about one of their RPGs on the on an earlier episode, Capcom, Destiny of an
right?
Emperor.
Destiny
yeah,
Emperor.
We did.
Did they make any other RPGs? I mean, like...
Sweet Home.
Yeah, I was going to say, speaking of holy grails, they did release some kind of interesting Japan-only games. Not a lot, but... Definitely probably the biggest one was Sweet Home.
Right. Which,
what, not Pro Baseball Serial Murders?
That's the other one I've got here. Pro Baseball Serial Murderers is mainly notable because it is basically the game they were supposed to be making while they poured their heart into Mega Man 2.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that. Mm-hmm. Cool.
But Sweet Home is a much more notable title for being the prototype for Resident Evil in a sense. But I haven't played it, so tell me about it.
It's super ahead of its time. It's an RPG where you have, I believe, is it 5 characters, Ray?
Yeah.
And it's based on a movie that came out around the same time. It's right. A licensed game. And
so it's the Parasite Eve of its day.
Right.
Oh, yes.
Right. But it is eventually, it kind of spawned Resident Evil eventually, because you have the door animations, you have the exploring a spooky place with more than one character. But in this game, you had 5 characters that you could split up, and you had to split up to solve certain puzzles. But then there was an RPG battle system, so it was a weird mix of like adventure game and RPG, all from an overhead perspective with a horror theme. So, and it's all fully translated. I think we talked about this on the Fan Translation episode. So,
yeah. And the battles all have like that weird chance meter thing where your commands may not always hit.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, this. Yeah.
I need to play through it. I feel like that's a huge gap in my RPG knowledge.
Yeah.
And
they weren't too big in our RPGs otherwise.
No.
A little bit.
Not until Breath of Fire, really. Mm-hmm.
That's right. No.
And now they're still not big into RPGs.
That didn't last
very long. I guess if you consider Monster Hunter and Deep Down RPGs. Or not Deep Down.
Oh, yeah,
Dragon's
Monster
Dogma.
Hunter.
But yeah, that's pretty much the gamut of Capcom stuff. They did have some sort of oddball late-era NES material that kind of spanned a wide gamut. There was Gargoyle's Quest 2, an NES sequel to a Game Boy game.
Yeah.
That was later ported to Game Boy.
Yeah.
Oh, crap.
it was reverse ported or whatever. Yeah. That's one that I've never played. I really liked Gargoyle's Quest, but I've just never played the sequel.
So, I hear it's good.
Yeah, I mean, it's on. That's another one that's on the Japanese virtual console, so hopefully that'll come over here. Another one is Codename Viper, which was not a port, but is basically the most shameless ripoff of Rolling Thunder I've ever seen. Uh-huh. I mean, it's incredibly similar to Rolling Thunder.
Oh my god,
it's crazy. It's really good. It's really well made. It's called Dead Fox in Japan for no particular reason. It has the usual like Metal Gear, your boss is actually the bad guy twist. In this case, he's like a drug runner or something. I don't know.
Oh, no. But, that speaks to the 90s.
Yep. I mean, it mostly takes place in tropical South America, and it has a very tropical look to it. Mm-hmm. Like lots of greens and earthy browns. And then the final level is your commander's basically a big palace. It's full of weird elevators and stuff.
Yeah.
That was a pretty good game, you know, despite the fact that it was a total ripoff. And my main memory of the game is actually for a while, a friend of ours was staying with us for a month. And he was about my age. And he never really played video games, but for some reason he got really addicted to that. And he would spend hours and hours trying to beat it. It's like a 6-level game. And it took him weeks to beat it. And, you know, it has passwords to start at the beginning of every level. He just wasn't that good at video games. But eventually he persevered and he beat it. And he was just so proud of himself. And wow. I was proud of him too. And also happy that I wouldn't come home and see that game playing every time.
Yeah, no kidding.
I'm looking at the box art for this game, and one thing we forgot to mention that I just remembered now that is that the Capcom USA's box art template had two phrases on it.
State of the art graphics
and high resolution.
High resolution.
What is a high resolution NES game? Can someone help me out here? It's, I feel like that's false advertising.
Yeah.
256 by 224.
Yeah, you can't get higher than that, guys. What are you doing? but also the whole Captain Commando thing, I guess you mentioned it earlier.
That was kind of a US marketing thing where the Captain Commando was like their mascot, who was this dude with like very 70s disco looking space warrior, mm-hmm. broad collar, open shirt, I think, flowing blonde hair, guns in both hands.
And he offered you $10 off other Capcom games, yes. I think.
Yeah.
And possibly a sticker or something, I don't know.
Yeah.
He's sort of like the hero from Far Cry 3 Blood Dragon.
That's true, wow.
I don't know if they developed internally, I don't think they did, but... For whatever reason, when Taxan decided not to publish the G.I. Joe NES sequel, Capcom did. But I think that was developed by Kid. So at least it looked like all of Kid's games. It looked like the first G.I. Joe and had that same sort of weird, like, circular, globular art style in the background of, like, low G-Man.
That's right.
Oh, man. Sure.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Some weird stuff. But that's actually about it. I mean, that's quite a few games.
Did I
skip anything?
No, nothing.
Are we only talking about NES?
Yeah,
I wasn't sure
NES.
If Game Boy was part of this or not.
You didn't skip anything important, but I did play a lot of Gold Medal Challenge 92 because I got it.
What was that? Was that like sports?
It was supposed to be like their Barcelona Olympics game. But yeah, it was just track and field as a Capcom game, essentially.
See, that's why everyone gets Capcom and Konami confused.
What about things that Capcom did not release, like the California Raisins NES game?
Oh, yeah. Oh, I forgot about Yo-Noid.
Yes. Well.
Which was Magic John.
No.
You're thinking of Totally
oh,
Rad.
Oh, no, that's Totally Rad.
Yeah.
It was a similar conversion for the US, though.
Yo-Noid was Masked Ninja Hanamaru for the Famicom.
Yeah.
Very similar game to Wagyan Land from Namco. Mm-hmm. And it's, in fact, like...
Like with quizzes and stuff between stages?
Right. Pretty sure, yeah, probably developed by the same people, I'm sure. But also, like, Yo-Noid and Hanamaru were, like, released in the same year. So one was finished before the other, I'm sure. But never released until then.
Yeah, that's such a strange video game. They made a video game about a marketing campaign.
Yeah. I mean, there was the 7-Up
cool
game.
Spot,
yeah.
Like I just said, California Raisins they were going to make as well.
Yeah.
Yep.
I had like an issue of Game Players. I had an entire like blowout of California Raisins game screenshots up until the end. I mean, the game's finished.
Yeah, it was
right?
finished basically.
Oh yeah, I guess so. I mean, there's the prototype ROM is out there now, so you can definitely.
I mean, I think by the time Yo-Noid came out, I think Noid Mania had passed, had long since. But I don't remember the Noid being on the tips of our tongues as children. It felt like
The Noid campaign lasted for several years, so I think it was still kind of, you know, waning at that point.
I guess so.
Maybe Bob and I were just young enough to not have it imprinted on our
lucky you.
Yeah.
But I mean, as a game, I don't think it's really that bad. I feel like people just paint it with this brush because of who it's associated with, but it's an okay game.
I didn't think it was that fun.
I mean, it's not terrible. It's not like Cosmic Capers or whatever the hell, or like a Color Dreams game.
Oh, yeah. Captain Comic.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, it just doesn't stand out, really.
It's okay.
But, I mean, you could say the same thing about Ninja Turtles games, basically. They're all pretty standard beat-em-ups. I mean, they don't really change up anything, necessarily, but they're all right. You know, you didn't waste a childhood
with them.
But
you're confusing Capcom and Konami again.
No, it's on purpose. Jeez.
Yeah. I don't think we mentioned...
give me a break.
I mean, I mentioned... I briefly mentioned, but Little Nemo, it was a licensed game for a movie that did come out here? Didn't come out here? I don't remember.
It did.
It did? Okay. And it was just really, really great use of the license, even though I don't think Nemo climbed into animals' mouths. But I just like how weirdly, bizarrely inventive it was with all of those forms. It felt like a real Mega Man-y kind of thing.
Yeah, I'm actually kind of disappointed to know that it was based on a movie that was released around that time because I really want a video game based on a cartoon property from like 1910.
Yeah.
For the longest time, I was like, wow, that's such a random thing for them to base a cartoon on, but that's cool.
Yeah.
Oh, it's a movie.
There was no Gertie the Dinosaur beat him up.
But that game is also a good symbol of games that were just trying to rip off Mario 3 in a possible way, because that happened a lot in Japan.
The rabbit suit.
Yeah.
Frog suit.
Yeah, this, once Mario 3 came out, like, everybody was trying to make a game just like it.
This is a sidebar, and I want to do a live stream of this game, but Tiny Toon Adventures for the NES is such a Mario 3 ripoff. Sure. But it is Mario 3
That's
made...
not Capcom, is it?
No, but it's a sidebar.
It's Konami!
We're talking about Mario 3 ripoffs. That game is made by jerks. It is like Mario 3 with all the fun removed and extra punishing. It's like the Dark Souls version of Mario 3, but it's not fun.
Okay.
Like, watch for the live stream, people. It's coming.
All right. Well, clearly we've talked about everything we have to say about Capcom NES, because now we're just talking about Konami again.
And what about Bucky O'Hare?
It happens.
And the little people.
Damn it. Okay. So I guess that's about it. Any thoughts on the legacy of Capcom's NES games?
It's certainly a great legacy, one that people usually refer back to when complaining about them now.
Mm-hmm. That's true. Yeah.
No doubt.
Yeah, I mean, for the longest time, I really felt like Capcom could do no wrong. It helped that, you know, they were really strong going into the 16-bit generation too. They kind of phased out their 8-bit development in about 1992. So like some of their late games, Chippendale's Rescue Rangers 2, DuckTales 2, like pretty hard to come by these days because they were produced in small quantities and they switched over to Final Fight and Breath of Fire and games like that. But, you know, like it was a really great console legacy and really established them as a premier Nintendo developer, like a third party you always watched for.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I think once they switched their box art template to like that purplish hue, that you know, that really became like something you looked out for, and like with the Konami silver boxes, like you had a good chance that this was going to be good.
I mean, not coincidentally, I think that started with, I want to say, Bionic Commando.
Hmm.
So there you go.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah. It was more early 90s when they changed over to the purplish boxes.
Well, they got rid of the. They got rid of the grid.
They did, but Bionic Commando was just different in that sense.
Oh, it's been a while.
Yeah.
Okay.
They were moving towards it, let's say.
All right.
Yes.
The transition had begun. Okay. So anyway, that's Capcom. Thanks to Larry. Oh my God, I forgot his last name.
Fronzik.
Thank you, Larry Fronzik, for suggesting this topic. Thank you, everyone else, for listening. Thank you, Bob and Ray, for sitting in this stuffy, stinky vault with
me.
No
problem.
And that's it for this episode. Be sure to check us out on our website, retronauts.com. Check us out on Twitter, on Facebook, on Twitch TV, on YouTube, on I think that's it.
That's it.
Yeah, we're Retronauts in all those locations. Stay in tune, stay in touch, etc. Go to iTunes and tell us that we're cool. Tell the world that we're cool. You don't need to tell us. We're okay.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you're interested in supporting us through merchandise, you can go to fangamer.com.
I think it's .net.
.net.
But if you just type fangamer into just your Googler.
And they sell a Retronauts t-shirt and it's really cool.
Right.
And I need to buy one. And I guess that's everything. So thanks again. And stay tuned for next week when another episode will be flying your way through the ether.